This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Margaret Morales, Senior Research Associate for Sightline Institute, a think tank providing leading original analysis of energy, economic, and environmental policy in the Pacific Northwest. Margaret Morales is here to tell us about the effect of Seattle's zoning regulations on structural school segregation and to discuss how increasing housing options in single-family zones could allow more students with diverse economic backgrounds to attend Seattle's top public schools. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Sightline Institute?
Sightline is a regional think tank. So we focus on sustainability issues for Cascadia, and Cascadia mostly covers Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia. And we look at sustainability pretty broadly. So we're interested in environmental impact and also social and economic impact of issues across the region.
Before we go into detail about the effect of single-family zoning restrictions on structural school segregation, let's set some context about the pattern of housing types in Seattle. What does the pattern of Seattle's housing stock look like?
Well, let's see. So housing in Seattle is dominated by the single-family detached home. Not quite a half of all of the homes in Seattle is that one housing type. And when you look at zoning, it's really the zoning pattern that has led to that. So over half of Seattle is zoned single family. And in those zones, all you can build are detached homes and also accessory dwelling units, which are, there's things like granny flats or backyard cottages. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of those in Seattle. But for the most part, when you're looking for housing in Seattle, your choices are limited quite a bit by the fact that this one zoning type covers so much of the city.
To what extent are there also duplexes and triplexes in these single-family home areas?
Right. So there are duplexes and triplexes in the multifamily zones. But again, multifamily zones covers a pretty small portion of the city. Well, now what's interesting is that we're finding there are many duplexes and triplexes in single-family zones. They're not legal to build those housing types today. Those are relics of a more flexible zoning history that we have here in Seattle. When the zoning code was more flexible, they were built. And then as many neighborhoods have been downzoned, those duplexes and triplexes were grandfathered into the neighborhoods.
What is the geographical pattern of the diverse housing stock? What does a map of multi-unit homes and single-family neighborhoods look like if you look at the map of Seattle?
So housing types in our single-family zones are extremely homogeneous. We don't see much diversity at all. We are lucky and benefiting from historic zoning code, which was much more flexible and resulted in a number of grandfathered-in units. Things like these duplexes and triplexes. So they are the only reason we see a little bit of diversity right now in our single-family zones. We see most of these grandfathered-in units closer to the center of the city. The northern and southern extremes of Seattle, we have fewer of these grandfathered-in units in the single-family zones. But we think that we need a lot more of this. This is just a good little foretaste of what could come if we opened up single-family zones to a little more diversity.
How many extra people are likely housed by the diversity in housing stock that exists in single-family areas?
So these grandfathered-in units, plus the accessory dwelling units I mentioned, create capacity for an additional 12,000 people, we estimate, in the city. So it really is a wonderful contribution to our housing supply that these units are providing us today.
What is the economic status of people living in plexes and accessory dwelling units?
What we think is really interesting and exciting about these diverse housing options is that they create a range of housing choices. So they're coming in at more diverse price points in these neighborhoods, and they create rental options in neighborhoods that are dominated by owner-occupied single-family homes.
Would you say more about how the changes in zoning over time have affected the pattern of housing stock?
So prior to 1923, Seattle didn't have a formal zoning code. And so builders could be very reactive to what was needed. They could build what was needed, where it was needed across the city. And there were advantages and disadvantages to that. So 1923, the city saw its first zoning code hit the books, and it was very flexible compared to what we have today in zoning. There were only two residential zoning types. One was the equivalent of what we have today of single-family zoning. And the other was second residence zoning, which was any housing type beyond a single-family home, so from a duplex to an apartment structure. And the way that these were distributed was most of the single-family zone was on the extremities of the city, the northern and southern portions, whereas the more flexible residential zone was around the downtown core. And so that is why today we have more housing diversity around the center of the city than we do on the extremes.
You've presented a block in Wallingford as an example of how zoning has affected a specific area. Would you like to describe the block that you've talked about in your study?
Sure. I just kind of profiled a pretty typical block in the Wallingford neighborhood. So Wallingford is one of the neighborhoods in our city that's benefiting from these grandfathered-in units. The block that I looked at in my article had a number of duplexes and I think a triplex as well, and they were almost all built prior to 1923. So most of these grandfathered-in units were built prior to the first zoning code, and then we see some more built after the first zoning code in neighborhoods that were later downzoned to single-family zones.
What are Seattle's current zoning regulations for housing? Could you just underscore exactly what our zoning regulations are at the moment?
Sure. I think it's important to make clear zoning is really just the set of rules that a community puts on itself regulating where we can build what types of buildings. So they're community-imposed rules. And in Seattle, we have a zoning type, single-family zones, in which you can only build detached single-family homes, and it covers more than half of the city. So it really has kind of metastasized since 1923. It began as only a small portion of the city, about a third, and now it's over half of the city is covered by the most restrictive zoning type we have on the books.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Margaret Morales, Senior Research Associate for Sightline Institute. Our topic is structural school segregation and Seattle zoning. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Why did you choose to study the connection between housing type and educational opportunity? What is your goal?
Well, there's an exciting opportunity in Seattle right now. The city is considering letting its zoning code become more flexible. And so we're interested in what would happen if this policy proposal went through. So we're looking both at how the existing zoning code in Seattle is impacting a variety of factors, and education access is one of those. And then we're looking at how if we made our zoning code more flexible, more adaptable to the housing needs we see today, what would the result of that be? So that's how we went to education. That's a big amenity. It's a big opportunity in the city, and we're interested in how changing the zoning code would change access to education.
How was your study set up? What did you evaluate?
So we looked at public elementary schools in Seattle, and there is a rating system. It's actually a national rating system of schools in the country. It's called the Great Schools Index, and it ranks schools from 1 to 10. 10 rated schools are those that have the strongest performance on standardized tests, and schools with a ranking of 1 have the lowest performance. So this is just, you know, one metric of looking at school strength. It's not the full story, but it's a useful metric for us. So we looked at those schools that rank really high on this metric. They have a 10 rating. And then we looked at what is the zoning around those schools. And so around Seattle's top schools, we found that there's a disproportionate amount of single-family zoning. So already, single-family zoning is just coding this city and really restricting our housing options, and that is even exacerbated around our top schools.
So what would you say are the key findings of your study? You have started alluding to that already.
So first, we found that housing options around the top schools are very restricted. So when you look at the attendance areas, that is the area from which a school draws its students. Almost 3/4 of the attendance area of the top schools is single family zoning. So you don't have a lot of housing options if you want to get to go to one of these schools. That's the first thing we found. Then we found of the housing that does exist around the top schools, it's very expensive. It's about 20% higher than the average home price in Seattle. So you have only one type of housing option, really, single family homes, and they're expensive. So not surprisingly, household income of families living around these top schools is also higher than the Seattle average. So what's the result of these three factors? You have a very homogeneous housing types. It's leading to homogeneous economic background of the people that can afford to live in these neighborhoods. And the result is that the schools, the top schools in Seattle, are homogeneous. So we're seeing that the student body at these top schools is overwhelmingly white, non-poor, and English-speaking. And that, we think, is in large part a result of the restrictive housing types around the schools.
What are some examples of specific neighborhoods that illustrate your general findings?
In my most recent article, I looked carefully at a school, the View Ridge Elementary. It's in the View Ridge neighborhood. And if you look at the attendance area, 93% of the land around View Ridge is single-family zoning. And so most of the homes around View Ridge are single-family homes, and they're very expensive homes. I think the average home value is like $850,000. So Seattle's already expensive. That's even more expensive. And then we kind of looked at the breakdown of the student body, and we found the same things. You know, a much higher percentage of students at View Ridge Elementary are white, non-poor, and English-speaking than you see across the district. So you're getting kind of enclaves of students at these top-performing schools.
Based on your study, what do you propose as a solution to make better educational opportunities available for all economic groups?
So I think we're going to need a range. We're going to need a suite of policy tools to create more equity across our school system. Zoning policy and housing is just one tool in that toolbox. That's the one that we're looking at. And I think that if we can create more diverse housing options, so a wider range of price points around good schools, a wider range of housing options, you know, maybe not all families are ready or even want to own a home. So there needs to be rental options around these top schools. If we can create that kind of diversity, it will give us more diverse neighborhoods and it'll give us more diverse schools.
How can a more diverse housing stock be encouraged?
So what we're very excited about is a policy proposal. It's in front of the Seattle City Council right now, and it's part of a housing affordability policy package that Seattle received in 2015. And one piece of that package is to broaden what types of housing can exist in single-family zones. And that means allowing things like duplexes and triplexes and some row houses to also exist in single-family zones. These are kind of small multifamily options. They're all within the existing size constraints of single-family homes. So we're not proposing building enormous new structures in single-family zones. We're proposing building a greater diversity of same-size structures in these zones. So we think if we could create this kind of broader diversity of housing choices, these duplexes, these triplexes, that would allow a greater range of neighbors in some of our most expensive neighborhoods.
What is the timeline for the City Council deciding on this proposal for relaxed zoning requirements?
Well, we hope that the City Council will turn to it sometime this year.
What are the key barriers to housing stock diversity in addition to zoning?
So in addition to zoning restrictions, there are also restrictions on accessory dwelling unit construction in our single-family zones. So accessory dwelling units, these are things like granny flats or basement suites or backyard cottages. And while it is currently legal to build these on a single-family plot, a single-family parcel, it's extremely difficult in reality. And that is because there is just whole phone book worth of regulations on ADU permitting. So one regulation, for example, is that if you want to construct an accessory dwelling unit at your home, you have to show proof of 2 off-street parking places. So that would be 1 for the main home and 1 for the additional unit. Now, that is incredibly difficult to get in Seattle. And so it's just kind of a whole laundry list of things, very difficult permitting requirements. As a result, only slightly less than 1% of single-family homes in Seattle have an accessory dwelling unit associated with them. And that is so much lower than many world-class cities. If you look at Vancouver, BC, over a third of the homes there have at least 1 additional unit, and sometimes 2. So Seattle is really lagging behind, and it's because of these policy barriers.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Margaret Morales, Senior Research Associate for Sightline Institute. Our topic is structural school segregation and Seattle zoning. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Are there any efforts that are coming forward to try to make it easier to build the accessory dwelling units?
There are. So working to make accessory dwelling units more feasible by reducing some of those policy barriers, that's another piece of this policy proposal I mentioned. So this policy package, it's called HALA, it's the Housing Affordability and Livability Agenda. It contains a host of policy proposals for Seattle to address the housing crisis we're experiencing in this city. And so that includes both making our single-family zones more reactive to what we need in terms of housing and reducing policy barriers to accessory dwelling units.
What are some of the concerns you've heard people express about the accessory dwelling units?
So I think many neighborhoods are nervous about having more accessory dwelling units. And there are a host of reasons for this. One is that people worry about parking. They worry that there's not going to be enough space to park my car on the street if there are more people living on my block. Well, I think that points to a deeper issue that we have in this city, which is that the city is not walkable enough. We shouldn't all be parking a car on the street. And the only way to make a city walkable is by having enough people to support good transit and enough people to support local businesses. So you kind of have a chicken and egg problem here. We need to get out of our cars. That's the real problem.
In addition to affording more educational opportunities to lower-income families, in what other ways would single-family neighborhoods be affected by the proposed HALA zoning changes?
Yeah, I think that if we were to open up single-family zones to a greater diversity of housing options, those neighborhoods would probably see a greater diversity of neighbors. There are families that right now can't consider looking for a home in View Ridge, for example. They might be able to find something there. Maybe there would be a duplex. So you'd see maybe some more diversity across our city, sort of more mixing across neighborhoods. We've also been doing some research looking at other city amenities that Seattle residents might get access to if we broadened our single-family zones. So we've been looking at parks, and I think a lot more people would have access to some of the wonderful parks in this city if, again, we created more housing options in single-family neighborhoods. The neighborhoods might start to look a little bit different if we permitted more housing types. But again, the proposal is very sensitive to single-family zones in that it's not proposing enormous new buildings in our single-family neighborhoods. It's proposing buildings that are consistent with the style and the size of buildings currently in those neighborhoods. And finally, and this is my hope for the future, if we permitted greater housing diversity in our single-family zones, I think we might start to see more local businesses and more walkable neighborhoods. Because again, you need neighbors to support those things. And so if we could create enough patrons for your local chocolate shop, maybe you could have one that you could walk to. But we need the clients to do that.
How does your study fit into the overall picture of bringing equality to the public schools?
So again, I think that making our zoning code more dynamic and more responsive to our housing needs, that's just one piece of the story here. There has been a lot of research showing that the Seattle public school district, it's an exceptional public school district, but there is a lot of economic segregation across the district. Making our zoning code more flexible is one thing we need to do to address that problem. It's not the whole story. So I think it's a step along the path.
You alluded a bit to this earlier, but how do we compare with other major cities as far as the diversity of our housing stock?
So it is remarkable how much land in Seattle is covered by single-family zoning. That is quite unusual in a booming city like Seattle. So that is unique. And then when we're looking at world-class cities, you know, there are a lot more options for things, the equivalent of an accessory dwelling unit. So, right, I talked about the case of Vancouver, BC, where we see a third of the homes have an accessory dwelling unit. And here we're struggling to get 1%. So there's just a lot of restriction on what you can build where in Seattle.
What do you think the reason is that Seattleites have zoned themselves for so much single family compared to these other cities?
You know, I think some of it is that Seattle has thought of itself as a sleepy town. So it thinks of itself as just sleepy, quiet, small neighborhoods, and it is scared to change. But the fact is that Seattle and Seattleites are benefiting every day from the growth we're seeing in this city. I mean, every day, as new businesses choose to headquarter here, the entire city benefits from that. And so we have to make space for those new people. So I think we're having a little bit of catch-up between our zoning code and what Seattle has become. It's not a sleepy town anymore. It is becoming a center for technology and business in this country, and our zoning code is trying to catch up to that reality.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, so I think that when we restrict our housing supply by things like overly restrictive zoning, we put a major burden on members of our community that have the least margin in life, those with the smallest economic reserves. And so we're creating a housing crunch because of these rules. And when we do that, those people with the least margin in their life, the least buffer, they feel that crunch first. So Seattle has a choice right now to create a housing crunch because we're nervous about change, or to walk into that change together as an open community.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to say that zoning, you know, it's this big word. It sounds some like fancy, far-off policy thing. Zoning code are rules we impose upon ourselves. They are the rules we choose to say about where we can build what. And where we can build what affects people's lives, and we have the opportunity right now in Seattle to change that code, to change those regulations, and make more inclusive neighborhoods in this city.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Margaret Morales, Senior Research Associate for Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org/schoolzones. Again, sightline.org/schoolzones. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.